Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, July 10th, 2003. Today's session is Wisdom and Intelligence in the Classical Tradition, presented by Mary Catherine Pruess. The number is PRM 2003-01. Let's listen in.
So we're dealing with Greek and Roman stuff. I thought I should say burn it. They for the recording, they need to say it in Latin or Greek. I warned him I might. My name is Mary Pruess, and I'm not the Mary Pruess that does the singing here a lot. There are three Mary Pruesses around, so we have a sort of a joke. I'm a language teacher, so I'm Mary Pruess the verbalist, and the singer is Mary Pruess the warblist. And there's another one who lives near Tacoma who has a big herb farm, and she's Mary Pruess the herbalist. So I teach classics, which is Latin and Greek language, at St. Thomas, University of St. Thomas in St. Paul, also sometimes at Luther Seminary. And something that has affected my life totally is that 13 years of my teaching career has been seminary teaching in Africa, 5 years in Tanzania and 8 years in Nigeria. So, and that, as I'll be talking about teaching in Africa on Saturday at 9 o'clock, and that's something, living in Africa for a while affects your worldview irreparably, changed, or I shouldn't say as though it needs repair, but. This presentation on wisdom and intelligence was part of an all-day conference at St. Thomas that was entitled Wisdom and Intelligence, sponsored by the Peace and Justice Department at St. Thomas. And so there were people doing presentations on this topic from all different angles and from all different places. That is, we had a presentation on military intelligence, business intelligence, among the presentations on my wisdom and intelligence in classical tradition, in the traditions of India, in the traditions of China, Islamic, had all kinds of things. Went all day. It was very interesting. And my assignment, specifically, was to tell everything there is to know about wisdom and intelligence in the Greco-Roman tradition in 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. Bang! Here it goes. Well, tonight I can talk a little slower and take a little time for discussion on it, too. Shout if you can't hear me, or if you want to comment or question, feel free to break in. That's just fine. It's nice that this topic connects. It was when I hadn't really decided whether to do any teaching when I came here, but when I saw some of the other things that were up on the board and met some of the people, I thought, well, this would go very well, because Ralph Evenson has been talking some about wisdom, and listening in on his sessions, I kept thinking, ooh, that goes very nicely. What I'm talking about is the background of what he's saying, 2,500 years ago background. And I know one person in one of his sessions asked, is a smart person necessarily a wise person? And that is a very, very old question. And the wonderful thing about it is that we actually have the documentation from 2,500 years ago about what people thought about that question. To wit, here is my lecture. But feel free to interrupt. An Athenian sent off to the oracle of Apollo, the god of truth, which was at Delphi in Greece, asking who was the wisest man in the world. This was about 400 years before Christ. The oracle said, Socrates. When he was told this, Socrates reasoned that since the oracle is divine, it cannot lie, and since he himself knew nothing, the oracle must mean that he was the wisest man since he knew that he knew nothing. Mm-hmm. Now, above the door of the temple at Delphi was the inscription know thyself, dating from long before Socrates' time, the first wise word from the God of truth. What did that mean? I think our first thought when you hear know thyself, and that's thrown around a lot, is get thyself a good therapist. I don't know. What do you think of as the meaning of that know thyself? If somebody quotes that to you, what are they probably saying to you? Have you heard any other opinion than simply that you need to see a shrink or something like that?
It is meant in the psychological sense, knowing yourself. Mm-hmm. Psychological.
Yes, it's thought of as a psychological maxim or something. Yeah. Okay. But the earliest interpretation in Greece, what they meant by it, and it's a persistent one throughout Greek literature, is know that you are not God. Interesting. And a hint that that's what they meant by it lies in, on the other door, the facing door of the temple, was the inscription, nothing in excess. The great sin in Greek drama and in Greek literature is hubris. You probably know that word. Or spell H-E or H-Y, either way. It's a Greek word. Hubris means arrogance, setting yourself up against the gods, really, saying that you're on the same level that they are. You don't know yourself. You don't know what your place is. This is remarkably close to the primal sin, according to Christian theology, really. Adam and Eve yielding to the serpent's words, what really tips them is into doing what they're not supposed to do is, you shall be like gods. So there's a real connection there. Know thyself. Another thing that it means, besides that you are not a god, it means you are mortal. Know that you are mortal. In Greek and Roman literature, the gods are often, the word that's used for them is, instead of saying the gods, they will say the immortals. And that is what distinguishes them from us, mortals. We will die, they won't. You all know enough, you've heard enough Greek myths to know that the gods are by no means models of moral rectitude. They're just bigger and often worse human beings than human beings are, but they don't die. That's their distinguishing feature. And then there's this interpretation of Socrates, know that you know nothing, that's the greatest wisdom, to know that you know nothing. That is, know what it is that you do not know. This has a great run in Augustine, Anselm, Nicholas of Cusa, philosophical tradition in Europe. That knowing what you do not know. A proper appraisal of one's own knowledge and wisdom, a proper assessment of your own abilities. Augustine, for example, says that Peter, the Apostle Peter, is a very good example of a man who does not know himself. He says, no, I'll never deny you, and 10 minutes later, he denies Jesus 3 times. He doesn't know his own weaknesses, the weakness of his own will. But even at Delphi, where the god can speak only the truth, what you're going to get from the god is truth, intelligence and wisdom have to be applied, or intelligence has to be applied to what the oracle says in order to reach wisdom, to get the wisdom of what the oracle is saying. The actual utterance at Delphi is only the data. You've got to put it together somehow. The seeker has to use intelligence to solve the riddle and come up with wisdom. Nice example from one of the Greek historians. Croesus, the king of Lydia, was delighted to hear at Delphi that if he invaded Persia, you will destroy a great empire. He did, and he did, his own. The oracle didn't tell him which empire he was going to destroy, and he got defeated. Delphi or other omens will direct only in riddles. It's up to you to use your intelligence to put together the clues to find the truth, the wisdom of the saying or the sign. I like the New Testament word that's used, the Greek word that's used for what's always happening with Jesus' disciples, but they didn't understand. You know, often that crops up. Or the people who saw a miracle or heard his teaching or something, they didn't understand. The Greek word means literally, they didn't put it together. Synhemi is the Greek word. Philosophy, of course, means love of wisdom. That's philosophia, and that's what the Greek word means, love and wisdom. It's a Greek word for a Greek invention. But what was thought to be your object if you loved wisdom? Let's look at it that way. That is, if you were a philosopher, what was the wisdom that you were chasing after? Well, before Socrates' time, think of Socrates died in 399 BC. So think of about 400 before Socrates and before 400 BC. Pre-Socrates, it was natural science. That was wisdom, was natural science. That's what philosophy was concerned with. Think about that, because in the modern university, philosophy is over in the humanities department, and science is often a different building or a different section of the campus. Never the twain shall meet, except in logic. You do get mathematics and logic coming together. But they are pretty separate now. But to the philosophers of the time before Socrates, the love of wisdom motivated a person to look at the heavens and look at the natural universe using your intelligence to drive toward the big question. What is the universe made of? What is at the base of all reality? Two of the answers that are of most interest to us, because they seem rather modern, Pythagoras, he's about 600 BC. You know the Pythagorean theorem about the right angle triangle, remember that? That's that guy. Mm-hmm. He says that number is the base of all that is, all that exists. And that 600 BC sets science on the path of mathematical explanation of phenomena. That's what science is trying to do, is to explain everything mathematically. Mathos, by the way. No. Mathos is from which mathematics comes, means knowledge. And the Latin word for knowledge is scientia. So math and science are simply knowledge, as far as the Greeks and Romans are concerned. Then here's another theory. What's the universe made of that's really interesting? Is about 500 BC, Democritus in Greece says that the universe is made up of atoms. And the atoms are in continual flux through space, and they glom together and form things, seed of the modern atomic theory. There's a third answer that's almost up to Socrates' time. They overlapped a bit. Anaxagoras said that the basis of the universe was mind. Now we're getting to the idea of intelligence, an intelligent universe. Let's call it intelligence with a capital I. And a bit later, the Stoics were to develop that into their teaching about logos, which I'm sure you've heard that Greek word thrown out in English texts. The Stoics said that logos, which means really intelligence, too. And interesting that in Latin, these two are equivalent. In Latin, it's ratio, or ratio, from which you get rational. And in the Stoic philosophy, logos or ratio is the force that runs the universe. It's kind of like the law of nature being thought of as one thing. All of these efforts, it's important to know, every one of them operate on the assumption that the universe is intelligible, that it is accessible to intelligence. Now that might seem to us, duh, but that is not self-evident. Not very many cultures have come up with that. in the history of the world, it's an extraordinary assumption to make. It means that it's worthwhile, productive, to try to figure out how things work, to explain and even to predict how things work. Certainly the Greeks, like everybody else, admitted the inscrutability of the universe at points. Well, know that you are not God, huh? Yet you could put that to one side and you could examine and investigate and observe. And the universe would lend itself to that. It can be explained and described to a great extent. Then Socrates came into the mix, some before 400 BC, and Cicero, a great Roman writer, writes in the first century BC, said, Socrates brought philosophy down from heaven, because everybody else was looking up, you know, by the nature of the universe, by studying stars, by studying natural forces, and so on. He was interested in trying to figure out how the human part of the universe works by asking questions like, what is justice? What is reverence? What is the good life for human beings, both individually and in the state, in their community? And there maybe give you another Greek word, polis. If you're from Minneapolis, you probably know what that means. It means city. And that word is from the Greek city-state, which was an autonomous city surrounding lands. They were not under a higher government of a country, that they were autonomous. Socrates, by the way, had a very poor opinion of democracy. He says you wouldn't have a man train your horses who knew nothing about horses. Why would you have a man or a group of men govern who know nothing about governing? And he said, democracy, you elect people who don't know anything about what they're doing. It kind of looks that way, doesn't it? Of course, the ironic thing, of course, is that Socrates was the citizen of a democracy, Athens, which allowed him to ask all those embarrassing questions for a long time, till he was an old man, till he was about 70. Mind you, not without criticism. He is mercilessly ridiculed by Aristophanes, the great comic poet living at the same time, on the stage. And there's this parody of Socrates' activity on the stage, and people found it uproariously funny. But that's a democracy. That's free speech. People can criticize each other's views even on stage. However, we also know, probably, that Socrates was arrested, tried, condemned to death, and killed by the democracy. When did Athens reach a point where it couldn't stand the needling that it was getting from Socrates' questions, like what is justice, for example? What is truly good for a human being? What is truly good for the state? When did the period come when they couldn't stand that kind of questions? Wartime. Engaged in a war to maintain their empire, Athens couldn't stand the stinging of the horsefly. Socrates referred to himself as the horsefly, the gadfly, which is a horsefly on the state. War sends wisdom down the tubes. Socrates speaks of his activity as philosophy, love of wisdom, and distinguishes it sharply from rhetoric. Now, you have to know a little about Greek and Roman education. You could say maybe the goal of our education, maybe most people would say, to produce a well-rounded person that can live in our society and work gainfully and so on. The aim of Greek and Roman philosophy, education, is to produce good speakers. You have to be a good public speaker. So rhetoric was really the main course of education. But Socrates says wisdom, philosophy, deals with reality and with the unchangeable. Rhetoric just deals with appearances and what change and what changes. In Latin, this gets to be an argument between wisdom. Wisdom is in Latin sapientia versus scientia. Homo sapiens, wise type of human creature. And scientia is inferior, is thought of something inferior to sapientia. knowledge is inferior to wisdom. Now, I've drawn a little picture up here. The ancients often describe this as a kind of a pyramid that you've got wisdom at the top. Here's all the data, all the stuff, all the material of our daily lives, everything that our perceptions bring to us. Down here, intelligence is what orders those, makes some sense out of those, but there's wisdom is above that. I guess you could say a smart person isn't necessarily wise. Somebody can have this all figured out but not have gotten any farther than that. Now, I know that Americans don't like hierarchies very well, and I I've noticed Holden Village really doesn't like hierarchies. They won't even say Lord in prayers, so I guess you don't like this one at all. Let's make wisdom at the center of a circle, huh? Is that more egalitarian? And then put, here's all the data sort of flying around and intelligence kind of gathering those into a circle and then trying to get to the center of that wisdom. It's interesting, our language even reflects that. I was thinking we have a fondness for, you know, the reality of something is, how is this on the ground, we say, or the bottom line, or grassroots. Those are our favorite good expressions for describing things. So we don't like things that go up and down, I guess. Okay, then, in Greek thought, how did you get from all these disjointed things and bits of data and perception? How do you get to the state of wisdom? Well, here's some of the answers that they gave, or here's some elements of what you need to get there. Number one, hard work, effort of the mind. If we look at Socrates as an example, dialogue, discourse, that was how Socrates taught. Those require concentration, require hard work of thinking. We're familiar with the painstaking work of a scientist who's gathering all this stuff together and try to see what the patterns are. How does it fit together? Or a writer who is trying out something, rewriting, reorganizing stuff. We see this going on all the time, this hard work, this effort. Humility is another one. Know that you are not God. Now, no one ever accused Socrates of humility. His knowing that he knew nothing comes with a heavy dose of irony. Nevertheless, pretending to know or assuming that you know what you do not know brings personal disaster, and more seriously, it brings disaster to the polis, to the community. And so I'd say number three, how do you get from disconnected things to wisdom? Community has to be considered. Polis is an important word here because we often think of Greek philosophers as pursuing pure wisdom, unrelated to life, you know, some sort of airy fairy thing up here, or as champions of the individual. Not so. Wisdom is related to the polis, the state. That famous quote from Aristotle, man is a political animal, that gets thrown around all the time during elections and so on. You've heard that. Heard people say that. Well, what that, a political animal, and it's as though this is saying people are just incorrigible about wanting to have elections. That isn't really what it means. What it means is man, that is the human animal, is an animal that lives in a polis. He's a politikes animal. He's an animal that has to live in a polis, or he's nobody. It's our nature that we have to be in a community. The philosopher, the lover of wisdom, who has seen reality, goes back down into the cave. Probably in college or even high school sometime, you had to read Plato's Myth of the Cave about the person who thinks that reality are these shadows that he's seeing on the wall of the cave. He doesn't realize that they're only shadows, that the reality is behind him, and he doesn't see it. And Plato talks about the man who finally gets up out of the cave and sees things as they really are in the light of the sun, no longer looking at shadows. But he has to go back down into the cave. He doesn't just stay up there enjoying the view. He goes down to the people that are still there. There's a Greek proverb, one man, no man at all. One person is nobody. It's interesting that Africa, that's very much part of African thought. I haven't heard all of Peter's sessions, but I would think that that would have to come up. That in Africa, it is still true that Swahili, Mtu ni watu, a person is really people. A person who gets cut off from his community or her community ceases to exist, really. You are a person in a family, a huge family, because all your brothers are brothers and sisters. They count cousins, second cousins, even somebody who lives in the same area as you, you'll say that's my brother because they come from the same town, speak the same language. And a person who loses that, they might as well be dead. To them, they are dead. Now, here's another thing. How did you get from disconnected things to wisdom? By suffering. Not one we like to hear very much. But the Greeks had a saying, pathemathos. By suffering comes knowledge or wisdom. Now, interestingly, though, the word for suffering is the same word as for experience in Greek. So we might add to this what's necessary, time. It takes time to get from one of these to the other. I put this kind of far down the list because actually Western tradition makes less of this than African or Asian or Native American, which have maintained a respect for age as imparting wisdom. They don't say that all old people are wise, but they say that all people who have lived for a long time have learned a lot. Maybe they won't use their intelligence to put all that together, so maybe they're not wise. But there's a great respect for older people. In American culture, the thing has got reversed entirely. New equals good, smart, old equals obsolete. We've just turned the thing right around. But to an individual life, age brings experience, which leads to understanding and wisdom if you order that experience by intelligence. And in communal life, the counterpart in communal life is that history tells us the collective experience of the polis, of the city or of the community. And that gives you data to make sense out of as far as the whole state is concerned, or a city or a community of people. Another element of wisdom, taking into account the unforeseen, the recognition of something intractable in the universe, something that's not amenable to reason or to human invention. This becomes a stronger element, usually in times of great social uproar, when life is very uncertain. Every Roman city in every country during the period of the Roman Empire had a temple to the goddess Fortuna, fortune. And that, you know, the wheel of fortune thing, that's an ancient, ancient symbol. Fortune has a wheel. And you may be at the top of the wheel today, but unaccountably the wheel turns. You can get crushed by it tomorrow. It's almost chance, a temple to chance. You worship the goddess Chance. I think that in Christianity, the doctrine of original sin represents this element of what's intractable, unpredictable, irrational in human experience. I think Murphy's Law is actually the modern popular formulation of the doctrine of original sin, original sin is means if anything can go wrong, it will. To put it very simply. Then another thing too, taking into account death. Know thyself, remember, know that you are mortal. You're going to die. The Epicureans, that's another one of the big philosophical school, they never got much of a following later than the first century BC, but they had one profound idea worth knowing about, I think, and it's interesting to think about. They said, the fear of death is responsible for most of the misery of human life. And when you think about it, you know, you think about dictators, for example, people who get into power will not give up that power. They will do anything to hang on to it once they've got it. And it's the fear of death, knowing that they are going to die, and they are going to lose it, but by golly, they're going to stay that off as long as they can. Now, there's a strong sense that, in Western thought, that there is something external, there's something outside of the human mind that has to enter in to effect the crossing over from intelligence to wisdom. How are you going to get to that center, or how are you going to get to the peak of the pyramid? There's a lot of the idea that there's something outside just the human mind. One would expect this in Christian thought. For example, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. The Lord is there outside of human mind. And Augustine speaks of divine illumination, but it's there even in Greek thought too. When Plato writes about Socrates, Socrates talks about his, calls it daimonion, a little god, his inner voice, which tells him when he's about to do something unwise. So it's like there's something, it's speaking to him in himself, but it's like it's coming from another source. In Plato, the forms or the ideas, if you've read Plato, the unchangeable realities are separate from the world we perceive. That is, that there is a real thing called justice that exists somewhere. And every instance of just behavior that you see in this world is a reflection of that divine, really, I guess you could say, idea, form. The Stoics, the most popular Greek philosophy among the Romans, taught that wisdom lay in conformity to the logos, the intelligence that guides the universe. So that was something outside of me, although the Stoics, they said that each of us has a little spark, a little seed of that divine logos within us. Logos, by the way, being the root of the word logic. The reason that we can reason about things is that we've got a little bit of that in us. So for everybody except the atomistic Epicureans, wisdom does not lie entirely within the capability of a human being. There's something or someone out there in most classical thinking on this. Now, Western tradition history, if you look through Western history, here's something else about wisdom. It can be lost. An example, the scientists 300, 200 BC, before Christ, in Alexandria in Egypt, was a great center of learning of the ancient world. They argued about whether the universe was heliocentric, that is sun-centered, or geocentric. Is the earth at the middle of it, or is it the sun at the middle of it? Well, we learn it that everybody thought that the earth was the center of it until Copernicus, Galileo, 1400s, what was that about? Actually, there were scientists in Alexandria 300 years before Christ who said, no, the sun's the center. And others said, no, the earth is the center. And the earth people won the debate, and their science philosophy got perpetuated through centuries and centuries until Copernicus and Galileo started working on the question again and found, sun is in the middle. And so human beings can forget their place in the universe. Know thyself, know that you're not a god, know your place in the universe. We forgot that. Human beings forgot that they weren't the center around which all the sun, moon, and stars revolved. They also forgot that they inhabited a sphere and not a dinner plate. You know, we all also get this in school. I think everybody thought the Earth was flat until Columbus. The ancients knew the world was round, but that bit of wisdom got lost. They had done the mathematical work and so on. They knew it was round, knew it was a sphere. Now, wisdom needs grist for the mill. It needs matter to work on. We'd love to short circuit the progression, to go straight to wisdom, you know, just sort of by thinking real hard or something, you know, with our eyes shut. We'd like to skip the hard work to which we must put our intelligence. And I sense it always bothered me a certain disdain when I'd hear my children's teachers talking in school or other teachers. We don't just want to teach mere facts, and they usually say facts as though that's not worth anything. We teach children how to find facts, how to find information on the computer or in books, but I think we kind of ignore, there's got to be something here for this to work on. I think you do have to teach kids some mere facts. I think it would be a good idea. Socrates noticed this, and Augustine expanded on this, the fact that you can't find something unless you know what you're looking for. You can't tell a kid to go look up something on a computer if they don't know what they're looking for. They gotta have some facts to start with, some data. A friend of mine said, you can't give a carte blanche to a tabula rasa. Now I'll get your carte blanche, you know, means a clean slate to a clean slate. And I, at this conference, I must admit, I wanted to get in a little plug to St. Thomas students out there. If you don't understand that sentence, go study a language. And I was even so bold as to urge them to study Latin because it is a wonderful basis for English. That's 65% of English vocabulary is Latin-based. And you learn how sentences are structured and all that. Because intelligence needs not only data, facts, information, observations to work on, it needs language. Accurate, concise language in which to express and by which to order all this stuff. We think in words, and if you don't have the words, you can't think. I think it's very important to teach children vocabulary. And if you have, by the best way is, of course, that they would read widely and read hard books. I was out of the country for 8 years teaching in an African seminary and then coming back and teaching in the U.S. college students. And I had taught them from 85 to 90. Then I got back to American college and seminary students in 98, 99. And I noticed in that period a decrease in students' vocabulary. I'm finding all the time college students, I use a word that I think is a perfectly ordinary word because you see it in the newspaper and they don't, three people in the class understand what it means. So I think language is intelligence, wisdom. You gotta have language, you gotta build up language so that it's accurate, it's concise. Because that's how we think. I just read an interesting theory, I can't even remember where I read it. I think it maybe came up in a magazine article. One person was saying, the reason that we don't remember our birth, or the first 2 years of our lives, or 3 years of our lives, we don't remember anything about it, is because we haven't that language yet. We wouldn't have the words for it. We didn't have words for it. And that's why we can't remember it. Interesting. And also, I would like to urge the studying and thinking about language and expanding your own language for the good of the human polis, the whole human city. Study French or Spanish or Chinese or Arabic or some other language, living language that's not your own. The whole question of philosophy, what is the good life for a human being? That has to be answered not just individually, but with the whole human polis in mind. Thank you. Want to talk about anything of that? Or beg to differ? Or
a couple, I really appreciate this lecture very, very much. And I use the word lecture in a good sense, not a bad sense.
Yeah, it's
really, I wish I could be one of your students. Two things. One, now these days people say we don't think in words, we think in images. And increasingly in Christian churches even, there's fewer and fewer words, there's more and more images. And I'm wondering, with your experience as a classicist, what that says about the direction of our civilization. That's the first question. The second
That's
question.
That's true, I've heard that a lot too. Can I
sure.
go on that one before
yes,
I forget
sure.
it?
I've heard
people say that too, and wanting less and less emphasis on words. The trouble is, how do you transmit it then? How do I let you see my image of what the Democratic Party platform should be? Or something, or what justice would be without using words. We haven't figured out a different way. And ironically, I think everybody thought when email came up, people are going to forget how to write. But the interesting thing is with email, if you're using email, not just to write something, to, back and forth, to chat with somebody, but in your job situation, if your language is not precise, we have more and more email contact as the way that employers and employees work with each other, not face-to-face. You used to be able to get more a person's image, they could save a lot fewer words, and you could tell by their body language, by their facial expressions, by their pointing to things, the way they tone of voice when they said it, you knew what they meant, even if the words weren't all that great. But if you're emailing to somebody, you'd better be precise in your language. How would you, if we think in images, is our thought then going to be totally individualistic? Because we have no way to transmit it to anybody else except language, do we?
I'm on your side on this one. I really believe that it's important to be able to communicate verbally with precision, and as well as with eloquence. And I believe that increasingly there's a lot of difficulty in our society over precisely this issue. What you say is absolutely true. But my wife teaches composition, for example, at UCLA, and she finds exactly what you find. And grammar and all of this. So she's doing an enormous amount
it's
of
like
media
a,
work.
Yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. right. The other question I was going to ask is the word sophrosune is used in the New Testament a great deal. Where does that fit on the wisdom intelligence?
That's kind of practical wisdom.
And I believe the New Testament makes. I should know more like Greek New Testament, but
epistles. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's interesting. The Gospels, you hardly get any abstract words at all because it's narrative. Then the epistles are John some, but John is so repetitious and uses a few big words and that's. But in the epistles, you get. Sophrosune is some Sophia philosophy. Sophia is the word for wise. So sophrosune, you can see that that's got something to do with that. And it is a sort of practical wisdom, common sense, but with self-control too, looking at things intelligently. Mm-hmm. And that is in the lists. Paul has some lists, or the epistles have these lists of virtues and vices, and sophrosyne is something that crops up in their hands.
Thank you. Yeah. I have a question. Did the Greco-Roman tradition allow for the wisdom of a child, or the wisdom of the fool, a la Shakespeare, or the wisdom of a sudden insight? Or is that a subset of wisdom or something?
Plato admits that there is something different. Well, madness, which I guess we could say is non-rational. Plato talks about the madness of the poet, the lover, the drunkard, the small child. They have a sort of wisdom in some sense that's sort of outside of this figure. Yeah. It isn't connected with gathering data.
No, right.
Inspiration. It's a sort of divine inspiration under the influence of a god that the poets say these things. Yeah. They're getting it directly from some other source. It's not dependent on their perceptions and observations. Yeah.
My education on ancient civilizations is rather limited. So I was wondering why you keep saying Greco-Roman, because I thought they were separate times.
Yeah, they are. The Greeks, the great golden age of Greek philosophy Socrates, as I said, died in 400, mm-hmm. and then the period after him, the Epicurean, the Stoic, Cynic philosophies. Well, Aristotle, of course, is the immediate successor. There's Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. That's sort of like Grandpa, Papa, and so in Greek philosophy, the three big names. Greece wore itself out on civil wars, and Rome, over in the western part of the Mediterranean, was gradually expanding its territory and spreading its tentacles to North Africa and to Spain, but also east. And in 146 years before Christ, the Romans conquered Greece, and it became a Greek, a Roman, part of the Roman Empire. The Romans were not of a speculative tone of cast of mind much. They're great engineers, good soldiers. They were good at some things. They always recognized that the Greeks were much better than they were at the speculative stuff. And most of them didn't care. And they sort of thought, that's effeminate, some sort of stuff. We don't need that. But Cicero, interestingly, the greatest of the Roman orators and a great politician, very important in the politics of the century before Christ in Rome. He translated some of Greek philosophy into Latin and gave it a Latin vocabulary so people could talk about. And there are some Roman philosophers. He isn't considered a philosopher usually because they didn't really come up with anything original. He just takes the Greek. But he did come up with a vocabulary for it. And so the Roman philosophers really are reflecting on Plato or ideas that have already come up in Greek philosophy. There's a development in the Roman Empire. I think that the Romans thought about the Greeks kind of like Americans think about the French. We really know that they're better than we are at culture. They're somehow more cultured than we are. But we don't really like that, and by golly, we're a lot tougher than they are. They're a little wimpy, and so the Romans thought about the Greeks that way too.
Whereas the Greeks thought the Romans were bullies and arrogant.
Some friends of mine really wanted their son to take Latin when he was in high school in Portland, Oregon. And they had a really hard time finding any. It was at a very expensive private school that they founded, a Catholic school. So do you have any advice about that? Do you know what's happening to Latin?
I don't know how many other states have the thing that Minnesota has, a very interesting thing that high school students may attend colleges, nearby colleges, and take college courses for free. And so I always, at St. Thomas, I always have a couple of high school students in my classes that are taking Latin because they couldn't get it at their school. Mm-hmm. There are some states which have lots of Latin programs. Interestingly, Florida, Texas, Latin is very widely taught there. In those states, Massachusetts, New York, I think, still. Minnesota, where I come from, it seems like, oh good, here's another school adding Latin, and then another school has dropped it. So it seems like we've been on the same level for years, and about the only way to get it is to go to a college, or go to some private schools. Not even that many private schools have it in Minnesota either. Every so often there seems to be a little bit of a comeback, and we're in a sort of a comeback period right now. I think there, for instance, my Latin course classes at St. Thomas are much bigger than they were from 85 to 90 when I was teaching there before. That may go in a sort of conservatism is in the ascendant position right now, and then sort of going back to old things, but that's part of it. I don't know. But it is hard. I think you can get Latin, there are ways of getting, say, a Latin course on the internet or something like that. There are very good helps on the internet that go with Wheelock is kind of the standard Latin textbook for both high school and college. But it's not really very much fun to do it on your own, that's true. I don't recommend it except as a last resort. How many of you had Latin in high school or junior high? How many in college?
Latin was the only language taught in my high school, very small high school in Illinois.
I kind of fell into it by accident, too, because I said in my biography, I found out at the age of 12 that it was very much fun to live overseas and learn a foreign language. Well, that was Norway. My father was a professor and was an exchange thing. Norway for a year, and I got put into Norwegian school without knowing a word of Norwegian and had a very difficult 3 months, but really liked it by the end of the year. Came back to American school and thought, I'm going to do languages. We had Latin and Spanish. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't interested in Spanish. I should have been, knowing, the way the country's gone now, I should have done it. Well, actually, I did. I did a year of Spanish, I guess. But the Latin teacher was a very, very good teacher. And I had him for English as well.
I went into nursing, so it was a help. It really was.
Yeah. And now, more at St. Thomas, too, I find when I ask students why are you taking Latin, some of them are pre-law, medicine, anything to do with medicine, that's terrific, and law, both. But even one of my business major students said to me, and she wasn't a very good student, she was having to come in and, I was having to really help her to get her through the course, but she said, I have to write a little essay, one-page thing, every week for my business organization class or something like that. And she said, taking Latin has really helped me do that. Or I know how to organize sentences better. And she said, the teacher, I've got an A on everyone, and the teacher said, could you help some of the other students writing? So I was happy about that.
Thank you again.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.